Hello, and welcome to Russians with Attitude, the best analytical/philosophical show there is. Today with us we have Bob Wright, a legendary writer of non-zero fame, whose book was read by Bill Clinton himself, but unfortunately didn't do him any good. So, hello, Bob.
Hi, how are you? Good to be here.
Yeah. I'm very happy because not because the World War III is looming over all of us, not because Russian forces liberated Avdiivka, Robotyna, and Toninka, and we torched some Abrams tanks, or at least one of them, but because my childhood dream was finally fulfilled. You see, since I was a little boy, I dreamed of going to the Red Scare podcast, a prolific New York-based podcast run by an Armenian Jewess and a Belarusian Catholic actress. And when we finally were offered this opportunity, I frantically called all my relatives and friends, and I said to them in Russian, "We will be on the pod with Hachiyan and Nekrasova," to which I got a mixed reply, to be honest. My grandma was worried about me even talking to Armenian women, and my dad remarked that Nekrasova means non-pretty or not pretty in Russian, and he questioned my choice of female company. I get to tell you, it was a fun one, but excuse me for blabbering about my questionable choices in life. So, Bob, how has been life treating you the past 6 months that we haven't chatted?
I guess I can't complain. I would say, by the way, that you two are scheduled to be on my podcast as well. And so you can tell your relatives that and see how they react. I'm guessing you won't get much of a reaction. I'm okay. You know, the world isn't, you know, in all respects taking the direction I would have recommended, but I'm trying to cope with it and comment on it occasionally. You know, the Gaza thing has consumed a lot of my attention. When we last talked, I don't know how long ago it was that you were on my podcast and I was on yours, but, you know, this Ukraine was consuming a lot of my attention. And I'm still paying enough attention there to get a sense for what's going on. But, of course, Gaza has kind of consumed a lot of America's attention.
Yeah, that makes sense since America is, much more... well, probably not more involved than in Ukraine, but it's certainly closer to home, so to speak.
It is. Well, it's more divisive than Ukraine was.
Basically on Ukraine, it isn't really permissible in like the Overton window of American media to take the opposite position. But with the Gaza thing, it's much more common and you see it a lot more.
Yeah, you do see within kind of Trumpist circles dissent from, you know, the Biden-Ukraine policy for sure. That is not as heartfelt, though, as, you know, as both sides of the Gaza issue are, I think. So there's not nearly as much intensity, although, of course, it really matters for from Ukraine's point of view. It's the reason they're not getting the weapons they'd like to get right now. Yeah, it's a very different thing. I mean, on Ukraine, you know, my position was, you know, I condemned the invasion. I'm a big stickler for international law. At the same time, I criticized America for having itself more or less ignored international law in comparable situations for so long that there was not a strong international norm against violating international law. And I thought America, after the Cold War, had kind of the power to establish such a norm or help establish one. But even saying that much and also recommending, as I did more than a year ago, that maybe it was time to just cut a deal with Putin and try to stop the fighting because it didn't look like Ukraine's situation was going to get much better. Those kinds of positions were pretty much outside the Overton window and especially in my own kind of progressive circles. I mean, really in my own progressive circles. If I had been like a Trump voter, I would have had... Well, more company on the second issue, at least, the issue of let's bring this war to an end and even use the fact that we provide weapons as leverage to help bring it to an end. Yeah, it's very different now. I mean, I feel I have a lot more company in criticizing Biden's Gaza policy than I did in criticizing the Ukraine policy. Company in my part of the ideological spectrum.
Well, we will return back to the Gaza and Ukraine questions, but I completely forgot to ask you, what are you guys drinking? I'm drinking Coke, but not Coca-Cola or even Dobri Cola. I'm drinking the organic stuff made from the cola nut directly. What about you, Bob? Go first.
I'm drinking turmeric tea with, I think, cinnamon in it.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I was supposedly it forestalls dementia, I think. Although, I guess the fact that I can't really remember what it's supposed to forestall suggests that maybe it doesn't forestall dementia. But I think it's supposed to forestall something.
I see. Maybe Biden also likes to drink that.
Maybe he should drink more.
Oh, yeah. Whoa. He probably drinks Coke, but, you know, the Coke Zero or something like that. Some symbolic stuff like his glasses, but I'm not well-versed in Bidenology at all.
No, I think Diet Coke is the Trump thing.
Oh, yeah.
The trademark Trump drink. I'm drinking coffee.
You certainly sound more healthy than yesterday when we tried to record the news.
Yeah, I'm still a bit under the weather, battling a cold, but I do feel better now.
All right. So let's return to the news. The first section will be about news, and the second more abstract about philosophy or the fate of Russian American, whatnot, and maybe about the new book that Robert Wright is writing. It is a worrying time because I really am now becoming convinced that the war of Russia against NATO is almost inevitable. And there are many bells ringing, and we need to talk about it with you. Because, well, I might be mobilized, but you, Bob, will probably won't due to your respectable age.
No, I'm too old. I'm not worried.
So we will never meet on the battlefield, and we need to have a dialogue of two sides. And speaking of which, before we do that, there is a random question. Do you remember in the late 80s, the tele bridges between Boston and St. Petersburg, televised bridge, like women and workers from Boston and St. Petersburg were talking. It was hosted by Vladimir Posner.
Well, you know what? Actually, I was once on in the 90s, a conversation with Posner, mediated by Phil Donahue, the talk show host, talking about my second book. I think The Moral Animal. I think, it must have been the mid 90s. Yeah. This was not exactly the same thing, but it was still a time when it seemed kind of remarkable that people in America were in conversation with other people. Posner was a big figure in America, kind of. I mean, as Russians went in those days, he showed up a lot.
Well, in the 80s, he was a Soviet journalist, but in the 90s, he tried to become an American journalist with the help of his friend Donahue. And I think he failed because what I liked actually about him is that he deceived the expectations. So Americans were sure that they would see some uncouth communist thug who can't speak any English and is dumb and angry. But he is a very much a different man. He doesn't have any accent, and which was suspicious. Mm-hmm. Incredibly suspicious for the American audience, and because he is originally from New York. He was born in New York and he went to school there until he was 9, I think. And then he moved to USSR, the actual land of opportunities. So, yeah, the new stuff. And let's get one thing out of the way. The mysterious destruction of one Russian warning and control A-50 plane. Yeah, a week ago, a 50 plane was destroyed. The Ukrainians have immediately claimed that they shot it down, but it seemed impossible because the plane was shot down deep inside the Russian territory, 250 kilometers from any Ukrainian AD systems. First, I want to hear Kirill's opinion on the matter, and Bob, you can also give your two cents if you have any take on the matter, because it is weird, and there were a lot of people talking about it.
It is. People talk about it because, it is kind of a normal thing, I guess, for, like, it's the usual reaction to everything on that, on the Russian side, you immediately have conspiracy theories, and on the Ukrainian side, they immediately take the credit for everything bad that happens in Russia, including, I don't know, random fires and domestic violence and whatnot. It's always a special operation. But the A-50, it's most likely a result of friendly fire. It would not be the first time. And if you look at Russian aircraft losses in the last 12 months or so, then over half of those were the result of friendly fire. Russian air defense systems have been a bigger threat to Russian airplanes than Ukrainian air defense systems. There are several reasons for this. One being just organizational problems, the lack of coordination between air defenses and the aerospace forces. The second thing being expansion of the Russian air defense network. And because of this, you have more inexperienced people in charge of these air defense systems than you would have in peacetime, because we suddenly need 10 times as many air defenses. And very few Russian air defense crews had any significant combat experience or anything. And it just takes time until it all settles in. And the third thing being that due to the Russian campaign to suppress Ukrainian air defenses, and it's being quite successful, the Russian aerospace forces have been a lot more active. For the first year of the war, so we barely saw any Russian sorties, except like firing missiles from inside Russian territory. But now you have many more bomb raids on the contact line. As we've seen during the hot phase of the battle for Avdiivka, you had 50 or 60 sorties per day. And this increase in volume just makes the act of coordinating between the air force and the air defenses more difficult. Like the only plane we actually lost during the final part of the Battle for Avdiivka was also lost to friendly fire. And it appears to be just one of those things that are pretty bad, but they just happen, I guess. In the case of the A-50, it's particularly bad because we don't have a lot of those. It's an AWACS plane, an early warning system, and I think we only ever built like 20 of those and only have like 10 or so in service. And the replacement, I mean, it is quite old. It's almost 50 years old. But the replacement, the A-100, it's taking a lot of time, I think. The very first time they even tested it with all radar capabilities turned on was like 2 weeks before the war started. And it will probably be some time until those go into serial production. And for the time being, the A-50s are still very important. And losing one is pretty bad.
Right. But it might be deeper than that. So Ukrainians claimed that they repurposed S-200 missile, and it does travel a long distance. The problem is that A-50 plane would easily detect it from afar and evade it. But what if Ukrainians played a trick and sent their S-200 missiles to harass A-50 plane in the Rostov region, right? Which let out his heat flares, and the Russian AD detected enemy missiles that were harassing the A-50 plane, and that's how they shot down the A-50 plane by mistake. Did you analyze it frame by frame or anything like that? I think there was a similar incident in Syria, actually, with the Israelis playing a trick on the Russian plane, and they forced the AD, Syrian AD, to shoot down the Russian plane. So
it sounds quite far-fetched, really. I don't think it was that complicated. I mean, the thing in Syria was different because it was Israeli jets that were physically in the proximity of the Russian plane. So right. It's kind of
not different. A missile, yeah.
Yeah. it was quite different from that. I mean, I'm not an expert in in aviation and technologies. That's really not my forte. But from what I hear people say, it's most likely just human error.
I see. Well, it's a big loss, losing the professional pilots and...
Yeah, as usual, the crew. I mean, in the case of the A50, the plane itself is also very valuable. But usually when you have these losses of like Su-34s or something, it's and when the pilots survive because they eject successfully, that is, it's not that big a deal because pilots are worth much more than the piece of metal they're flying.
Right. So after the fall of Avdiivka, the liberation of Avdiivka, there are many new developments, and one of them are the Russian advances in Robotyna. We have already captured, actually, Robotyna. The other thing that I noticed myself is that in Kharkov, the prices for local real estate have plummeted, and Kharkovans are selling their flats for half a price. I think the markets are speaking some truth. Now, an average cost of 1 square meter of real estate in Kharkov is around $300. And it used to be much more than that, around $700 a couple of months ago. So there is something to that because they're afraid of the Russian advances in Kharkov Oblast and Kharkov City. And they're voting with their hryvnia and trying to sell their flats to people who are less fortunate than them. So Russian troops are recapturing territory, but at the same time, Russian Navy has suffered casualties, now A-50 plane and all that. Also, we have heard a statement from Macron saying that he considers sending, or he might consider sending French troops to Ukraine to fight Russia. And it does seem to me that it might be the early stages of accepting that the big war is upon us.
The Macron thing actually had an interesting follow-up, so to speak. Hmm. The German chancellor said basically explaining why the German government will not send Taurus missiles. Said that Germany is not going to do this because it would require the presence of German soldiers on the ground to assist in targeting and using the Taurus missiles. And he basically said that Britain and France are doing this. But Germany does not want to do it because it would make Germany a participant in the war. And now you have like British and French media and politicians being very mad at Germany for revealing that British soldiers are on the ground launching the Storm Shadow missiles. There was one sentence in the news article I read that I found very humorous, that the German Chancellor's comments were seen as endangering British military personnel on the ground.
The story as it's being covered here seems to be that Macron has kind of been shouted down by, you know, by his allies, that there isn't any appetite for sending NATO troops into Ukraine. I mean, although, of course, there are, in some sense, some there already. But that's the way it's being played here, is that this, you know, that this idea didn't last long. It's also being reported that Putin threatened to use nuclear weapons if NATO did enter the war in that way. If you look at what Putin actually said, it seemed a little vaguer to me. Like he said, well, this would lead to, you know, a war that could lead to nuclear war. I didn't, maybe you know more than I do, but I didn't see him explicitly threatening to retaliate with nuclear weapons for NATO troops. But in any event, the idea doesn't seem to have legs, at least the way it's being portrayed here.
Yeah, most NATO countries most NATO countries that actually have armies did issue statements that they would not send troops to Ukraine. This is correct. And regarding the Russian response, I think it wasn't even Putin himself. It was Peskov, his press secretary. And he basically just said something to the effect that the presence of NATO troops would make a big direct military confrontation between Russia and NATO inevitable. So, I mean, that's not really a revolutionary statement that NATO troops fighting Russian troops would mean that Russia and NATO are at war. That is yeah.
I saw a quote from Russia with the term nuclear in it, but I'll maybe try to track it down. But anyway, it didn't sound like the kind of threat that the American headlines did. Some of them present it as a threat to retaliate with nuclear weapons, but that didn't seem to have actually been the case.
In any case, NATO is trying to poke holes in the Russian hard-to-replace Navy and Air Force and air defenses as much as they can. And they don't really care about what's happening on the ground, about Avdiivka and the mobilized Ukrainians. It's kind of like two separate entities. To me, it kind of feels like a preparation for the global war, but we will see. Let's take a short break from the SMO and talk about Navalny. So Navalny is dead. I'm in the camp that he died from heart failure. And sometimes the official version might be the truth. It wasn't the case with Prigozhin or Politkovskaya or Paul Khlebnikov, but Navalny's case is different. But what do you think, Bob, about Navalny's life and death?
I don't know that much about him. I just had a conversation on my podcast with Nikita Petrov, who actually used to work with me at my newsletter. He was a big Navalny fan. He went to demonstrations when he was in Moscow. He's not in Russia anymore. As far as the death, if I had to bet, I would bet that he was that the government killed him. But I don't purport to have great confidence in that. I mean, I'm mainly struck actually by his courage. I'm curious what you think about this. You know, he went back to Russia, maybe not knowing he'd die, but knowing that it wasn't going to be pleasant, right? And I think almost whatever you think of his views. I'm also curious as to what you have to say about that, because his views apparently were not as simple, certainly over his whole career, as they are thought of in the West, where he's thought of as a kind of an icon of liberalism. I think they were a little more complicated than that and varied than that. I'm also curious as to whether, although you two clearly don't agree with a lot of what he had to say, whether you kind of admire his courage.
So, yeah, he was the most popular opposition leader in modern Russia, and there's no doubt about that. But it's also the fact that in the last 3 years, Russians have forgotten about him. He became a relic of another era. Well, for obvious reasons, because the SMO mainly, and also because he was imprisoned. Even though I disliked his many talking points and his most of the people that he associated himself with, still I think this foolish decision to basically surrender himself to the Russian authorities for no reason at all was kind of noble. Stupid, but noble. At least it means that the man didn't just think about material comfort and money, but he also had delusions of grandeur. But I think that protesting is a legitimate form of self-organization. Even though I didn't like the Navalny protests, but I think I do believe in protests as a kind of a method, because there are really no ways to pressure the government, because, well, elections, they don't really work not only in Russia, but elsewhere. And protests provide ability to organize and for the workers to strike and so forth. Without it, there are no checks and balances in the system at all. And even though Navalny protested for a lot of wrong reasons, still, I think that Russian government would be better off if we had quality opposition within the state. Naturally, it's not. There's none of that right now. And the most popular opposition leader, he died in prison. It's kind of sad.
The lack of opposition is actually it is a very destructive feedback loop in a sense, because most opposition movements, as soon as they reach a modicum of like actual popular appeal or power or whatever, they get hijacked by what I would call the liberal establishment from the 90s, the people who came out of that establishment.
Yeah.
And it is very quickly tied to, Western governments. and which gives the Russian government every reason to crack down on them. And it is a very bad feedback loop in the sense that a lack of opposition is, of course, not very good for the political process inside Russia, because it makes reform much slower and things like that. The Navalny thing is a good example of that, actually. I do also believe that it's absolutely possible and likely that he died of, well, natural causes, in the sense that there was no assassination or poisoning or anything. But like, he went on hunger strikes, he refused medical treatment, and like, being in an Arctic prison is not very good for your health. And the Russian prison system is pretty bad. It's pretty terrible. And the quality of healthcare in the Russian prison system is also terrible. And the problem, like, I genuinely think that the federal penitentiary service in Russia is one of the most rotten and terrible institutions there is in modern Russia. It's in absolute dire need of very harsh and strict reforms. But this is not going to happen, because every organization that acts in that capacity or touches on that topic are like literal like CIA assets. Like, the most famous, probably, so-called prisoner rights movement in Russia is Guagunet, run by Vladimir Osechkin. And Vladimir Osechkin is also a terrible person who basically runs a blackmail service where he pays prison guards in Russia to collect like blackmail material on people and pressure people into like giving statements and things like that. So it is a very rotten organization and a very rotten cause, which is extremely bad for Russia overall, because Russia does need an organization that would pressure the government on prisoners' rights and the quality of Russian prisons and so on, because that is indeed one of the, well, a very severe problem. And it's not going to get solved, because the only people who try to pretend to try to solve it get sullied by association with Western subversive efforts, and as such it becomes impossible to even demand change, because that immediately gets you branded as a foreign agent, because most of the people who do this are in fact foreign agents. And
can I ask you a related question? Mm-hmm. So Navalny's widow says she wants to, you know, pick up the torch and sustain the movement. Do you think it was a tactical mistake for her to, right after kind of announcing that, to go visit Biden and be photographed with Biden, I guess, in the White House? I don't know. Yeah. I mean, that's what I thought. That's going to hurt. That's going to make it harder for her to sustain. Well, tell me exactly how it works. Is it that there are people in Russia who would be more inclined to support her if she hadn't done that? Or is it that her doing that affects things the government will do to kind of shut her down, or what? It did occur to me that it was not necessarily a good idea to be seen with Biden, but I'm not sure the exact dynamics.
I think that Yulia Navalny is very a different person, naturally. She lacks any charisma. She is not a politician or anything like that. She was never a public person, really. So it really shows. 3 days after he died in prison, she did this video on his channel that was shot in the style of late Navalny. But she really couldn't pull it off because she lacked his charisma. And really, you could believe that Navalny was an honest man in some sense. He gave off this vibe, or at least that he was a fool, but an honest fool that was mixed with bad people. And yeah, it eventually led to his downfall. But in her case, I don't believe her one bit. It kind of like the text that she was, it felt like she was reading some teleprompter. And all this was set up by other people, and it never felt natural. And actually, it's very bad optics for a widow to start a political movement like 2 days after the death of her husband, because it's supposed to be a grieving period. And the Biden is just a cherry on this cake that screams that it's a CIA operation. It's awful. It's badly made, and no one really fell for it, and no one actually protested against anything. Maybe it's another thing why Russians do not protest, and of course Kremlin is to blame partly for that, but also because she's not a believable character at all. And actually, I'm wondering whether she was actually a loving wife of Navalny at all, because she was so happy at the Oscars and then crying on the video camera and reading from teleprompter and then hugging it out with Biden. Yeah, it just awkward and bad all around, and no one really believes her. But I do have a dream for Russia to become a country where, well, the internal opposition is possible and it's not controlled. It should be a fierce opposition who are not traitors. Is this too much to ask? I don't know. Yeah. Because Navalny at times seemed like he could become that, especially, well, in the early period of his activism, like in 2009, 2010. But then all his friends and associates who were and are rotten to the core, triple passport, having literal agents of MI6, Soros goblins, and whatever. It's a mess. I wish for an anti-Putin bloc to exist, for example. But it's supposed to be completely pro-Russian at the same time. And I guess Strelkov tried to do that. Now he's in jail, partly because he threatened to kill Shoigu, Minister of Defense in Russia, but I really do hope that he gets out alive. And to add something to Kirill's point about Kremlin's logic and them being afraid of foreign agents, and they are legitimately afraid of Western-funded coup, and they had to deal with the onslaught of NGOs and regime change goblins and spooks, but I'm also sure that this situation is not sustainable forever. We cannot really turn into a North Korea or even Iran, partly because we have learned a very important lesson from the USSR. It's not just Russia, right? The US is also struggling with paranoia, and it was on full display in 2016 with Russiagate. And basically everyone is paranoid and constantly afraid, but being afraid is a sin. Worrying is praying to the devil. And I hope that it will take a few generations of Russians to construct a normal political climate inside my country. And I want for my fellow Russians to organize a beautiful Russian nation-oriented state with freedom of speech and all that, actual parties. But how can we get rid of American influence? Do you have any idea?
That's enough for a free segment. The full episode is available for our glorious allies on Patreon and Gumroad. See you there.